Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they absolutely had it right. And this is Tom Navolas, your host. And today I am so excited that, wow, we did a rerun for the Thanksgiving weekend. We've been extremely busy trying to get through the book. Reading that online as well, the book that is called The Chaplains and Clergy of the Revolution, which was published in 1864. And that was a remembrance book, and trying to remember what happened at the foundation, which now, here we are in 2018, we need to remember what happened at the foundation. And we're going to talk about that. We've had some really interesting times. We've had the election down there in Mississippi. And we've seen that we picked up another Senate seat. We're kind of going to talk about the peripherals of that. But we're going to talk today about definitely that we are already in a civil war. We have been in a civil war fundamentally since 1864. Civil War hasn't stopped. And then it just has become even more so as we've seen now in this 2018 election cycle, how the communists and socialists have really, really, really come out forcefully and have taken and attacked everything. So let me take you back just for a second. Is that what I'd like you to do is on the YouTube channel, the Samuel Adams Returns YouTube channel, go and take a look at what's going on with that book, The Chaplains and Clergy of the Revolution. Remarkable stuff. I challenge any pastor or church leader to read the book. The links are there. Links are in the promo that went out as well, or just take the time in the segments to watch the videos. It's like reading my grandkids is exactly the way that I set that up. So my grandkids don't live close by, so I have to talk to my virtual grandkids and introduce these types of truths to them because they'll never hear it in school. And they will never hear it from the pulpits or in the churches where it should be and had been during our founding era. So a couple things real quick. One of the things that popped up on the radar this past week is Mr. Pompeo taking and hiring a Never Trumper. I saw up on this creature called Twitter the question as to why did he do something like that? And the simple answer is, for all of you that are out there, the simple answer is very, 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 very simple, is that the churches have not prepared public servants to go out and participate in governing. Instead, what the churches have done is told everybody to go out and be a missionary and live in this bubble of the rapture, waiting for Jesus to come back, and so we have nothing but a bunch. And in most, there's exceptions. I know a lot of you that are listening to this program, but the majority out there are rooftop Christians and not involved even in their local government, their school board, or anything like that, to the extent that when it comes to national policymakers, what we have are the likes of who is there, and the swamp is full of them. Which brings us right to the point. It was predicted. It was absolutely predicted by the anti-federalists, and I will bring that up. One of the areas that we're going to go back and forth and through is that someone kept emailing me. I probably got it so many times via email, as well as my own personal email copy of it, and then my personal paper copy of it is the Imprimis. This most recent October version of it, and it is a very good article. It is America's Cold Civil War by Charles R. Kessler. Very excellent, excellent article. Kind of goes hand in hand with what I have written here in From Covenant to the Present Constitution. And the reality, in fact, is that we have been in a civil war since the 19th century. I got to do the math. The 19th century? When was that? 21st century is kind of where we're at right now. We, most of us, lived through the majority of the 20th century, at least half of it, if not more. Well, in my case, anyhow. And then you go, then 19th century. So if we do the math and we learn how that all goes, for those that don't remember these simple things, is that the 20th century was the 1900s and the 19th century was the 1800s. And just as a quick reminder as to where that Civil War happened, it wasn't just what happened in 1860s, but what happened prior to that. What actually happened within the first 30 years of founding this nation in and the new Constitution of 1797. When was it? You go figure it out. It's in the book as well. So yeah, I'm promoting the book because you know what? If you're not signing up for the seminars or buying the book, then you're missing out where our founders understood covenant. And what does that mean to then take us into that 19th century and developing that whole idea that our founders still, within the context of the Constitution, understood what covenant was all about. And unlike 1848, when, the Communist Manifesto came out, socialism was already creeping in. And then what we have in Wilsonian times under Wilson, who was the great promulgator of the what he talks about here is the liberal constitution, the living constitution, the anti-constitution. My goodness gracious, it brings us to today. And I think those are interesting points. And we'll jump back and forth between my friend, who I like, and you've heard me talk about before, and kind of the title of this program is with Melancthon Smith. Melancthon Smith was that great anti-federalist in New York. He was in the New York debates on the Constitution, and he was debating Hamilton. And Hamilton, being the arrogant fellow that he was, to the extent that even though Melancthon Smith would bring out valid and interesting arguments relative to section on, well, are we going to have proper representation within the nation? You know, are we going to have all of that correctly? That was a very good point. And there were some other points that Melancthon Smith made, and Hamilton and a couple others kind of slam dunked him on it in so many different ways. So what's interesting and very, very relevant to right now, what's happening in this election cycle, and as we move forward and prepare for 2020, this becomes extremely interesting. So I'm going to read Melancthon Smith's responses to you, especially this one on June 23rd, 1788. Oh, golly day. I just gave it away. Oh, I know you're smart enough to do the math, and so it was... Yes, the Constitution of 87 came out. Yeah, okay. Put fully into practice in 89. So here we go. June 23rd, 1788. Honorable Mr. Smith, he rose to speak again. I did not intend to make any more observations on this article. And they were talking about the article relative to the legislature. And he says, indeed, I have heard nothing today which has not been suggested before, except the polite reprimand I have received from my declamation. I should not have risen again, but to examine who has proved himself the greatest declaimer. The gentleman wishes me to describe what I meant by representing the feelings of the people. And this isn't talking about the House of Representatives. If I recollect right, I said the representative ought to be understood and governed by his conduct by the true interest of the people. I believe I stated this idea precisely. When he attempts to explain my ideas, he explains them away to nothing. And instead of answering, his distorts and then sports with them. Whoa, time out. All right, this is why I never get through this stuff, okay? What is happening in Congress right now, right today, except that the Democrats, and in this case it was Hamilton, who's taking and doing what? You know, somebody makes a very solid point relative to what is true, and then you have somebody that gets up and does what? Attempts to explain my ideas. He explains them away to nothing. And instead of answering, he distorts and then sports with them. But he may rest assured that in the present spirit of the convention, to irritate is not the way to conciliate the gentleman by the false gloss he has given to my argument makes me an enemy to the rich. This is not true. All I said was that mankind were influenced in a great degree by interests and prejudices, that men in different ranks of life were exposed to different temptations, and that ambition was more peculiarly the passion of the rich and great. The gentleman supposes the poor have less sympathy with the sufferings of their fellow creatures, for that those who feel most distressed themselves have the least regard to the misfortune of others. Whether this be reasoning or declamation, let all who hear us determine. I observed that the rich were more exposed to those temptations which rank and power hold out to view, that they were more luxurious and intemperate because they had more fully the means of enjoyment, that they were more ambitious because more in the hope of success. The gentleman says, my principle is not true, for that the poor man will be as ambitious to be a constable as the rich man to be a governor. But he will not inquire his country so much by the party he creates to support his ambitions. So what we have is, once again, right from the beginning of the arguments of the nation, was this idea of how do you toy with those in political power, of riches, of great ambition, in relationship to those lesser. But one of the things that in the closing sentence that Melanchthon Smith brings out is that those of greater wealth and ambition, those would be the ones that in forming party spirit and in forming parties and developing them, they would be of greater danger to the country than us, you and me, middle class, or those that are even less wealthy than the middle class. Because that's what Melanchthon Smith was arguing previously, is that the middle class need to have greater representation, and the potentials would be for wealthy to assume party spirit and become very involved and more or less control everything. So as we wrap up with this last minute, this is not anything new. As I always say, there's nothing new under the sun. So to that extent, we in the middle class, we see that separation, and we're going to get into it into the next segment a little bit more, is that we see the coast with all of the various riches and all of the hot shots, if you will, and the Hollywoods and the everything else and the Silicon Valleys, and what we have going on there, that then when you come to the middle and the heart of the country, we have to fight hard. And that's what we're going to be talking about in the third segment, is how we need to fight hard, because it's important that Sam Adams returns. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, those anti-federalists, they did. They absolutely had it right. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back once again to Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they absolutely got it right. As we heard from the last segment, we're talking about Melancthon Smith and his response in particular to Hamilton, and that what we heard in that first segment was that the statements of truth or statements of principle can be argued to nothingness. Not a new concept. Hamilton did that with Melancthon Smith, no different than Adam Shifthead does that with everybody else. Or you have crying baby Chuckie Schumer doing it, or you have the Pelosi lips. You know, anyway, that's not nice to talk about people that way. I know, I'm sorry, Lord. But the bottom line is these people's ugliness is not just at the surface level. And I'm kind of making, for those on the radio, a thing around my face because, yeah, hey, I ain't the prettiest thing to look at. So maybe it's better just to listen to me on the radio than watch me on YouTube. But the bottom line on it is that nothing new. You know, the whole way of arguing and disparaging and taking down an idea, a principle, has always been something in arguments across all of time. And what I wanted to also comment on is that you need to go look at the archives of this programming at samueladamsreturns.net. And that takes you a link to the samueladamsreturns.com as well. You can find where you can buy the books, as well as understand that right now we're still primarily on Liberty Works Radio Network. And Liberty Works Radio Network does work for your liberty. And I would suggest that you check out the other programming because, you know, it's got a lot of good stuff, especially in the afternoons when you have your live programming on, especially in the markets there throughout the mid-Atlantic states. So check that out. And thank you to Liberty Works Radio Network for having this character on and filling these two time slots here on Saturdays. So let's get back to Melancthon Smith because, you know what, I see that this is, you know, if we really want to talk about when the Cold War started on the cultural Civil War, Cold Civil War, as this Mr. Kessler talks about in the article in the Imprimis, I think that we look at, it was like a Cold Civil War back then, you know, between those that were what then ended up being called Federalists and Anti-Federalists, but those that were statists from the onslaught, and those that were really people of moral liberty. And that is the distinguishing factor even today, is that the people of moral liberty, understanding what John Adams and even Madison had to say, is that the Constitution was only for a moral and virtuous people. So let's get back to this idea of what's going on here with Melancthon Smith as he's taken in giving a retort to none other than Hamilton. The next object of the gentleman's ridicule is my idea of an aristocracy. And he indeed has done me the honor to rank me in the order. If then I am an aristocrat, and yet publicly caution my countrymen against the encroachments of aristocrats, they will surely consider me as one of the most disinterested friends. My idea of aristocracy is not new. It is embraced by many writers on government. I would refer the gentleman for a definition of it to the Honorable John Adams, cousin of Samuel Adams, one of our natural aristocrats. This writer will give him a description the most ample and satisfactory. But I by no means intend to carry my idea of it to such a ridiculous length as the gentleman would have me, nor will any of my expressions warrant the construction he imposes on them. My argument was that in order to have a true and genuine representation, you must receive the middling class of people into your government, such as compose the body of this assembly. That assembly being the middle class of New York were there in the assembly to argue the Constitution and to ratify it. I observed that the representation from the United States could not be so constituted as to represent completely the feelings and interests of the people, but that we ought to come as near this object as possible. The gentleman says that the exactly proper number of representatives is so indeterminate and vague that it is impossible for them to ascertain it with any precision. But surely they are able to see the distinction between 20 and 30, because at that time the argument was 20,000 or 30,000, one representative to 20 or 30,000 citizens. So that was really one of the key elements as to how do you best represent. And as you've heard me say before in this program, is in comparison to the representation being correct as closest to the people, how in the world is it that one representative can know what he said, the feelings and interests of the people, when that one representative has 1.2 to 1.5 million people to represent? Interesting. Wow. So he goes on to say, do you know the difference between the number 20 and 30? I acknowledge that the complete representation would make the legislature too numerous, and therefore it is our duty to limit the powers and form checks on the government in proportion to the smallness of the number. And there again, in talking about the legislature, is that, you know, these 400 clowns sitting in the House of Representatives, and, you know, some of them are pretty darn good. You know, I can think of a few, but let's take it that, okay, now Democrats, they've taken and won the House of Representatives again. So, my goodness gracious, you think they have any limits? And he's saying we should have limits on the powers. So, continuing, the honorable gentleman next animadverts on my apprehensions of corruption. In other words, he's picking on him about this idea of corruption and instances the present Congress to prove an absurdity in my argument. But is this fair reasoning? There are many material checks to the operations of the body which the future Congress will not have. And what was going on there is that even though it was very difficult to get something passed through the Articles of Confederation, Hamilton and such were taking and pretty much laughing at him about that, oh yeah, there's no corruption in the Articles of Confederation, right? Well, there may have been some, but the fact was is that you couldn't get a lot of legislation through that body without, you know, everybody agreeing to it. So that's what he was talking about there. There are many material checks to the operations of that body, which the future Congress will not have. In the first place, they're chosen annually, and that is under the Articles of Confederation, representatives were chosen annually. What more powerful check? They are subject to recall. Wow, wouldn't that be great, representative, to recall them? 9 states must agree to an important resolution which will not be carried into execution till it meets the approbation of the people in the state legislature. See, that was what was really important, is that the state legislatures had to agree within themselves before the national bill would be passed or spending of money. So it was really bringing government right down to the people in that better representative format. Okay, he goes on, omitting what he says, that they have pledged their faith to support the acts of Congress, yet if these be contrary to the essential interests of the people, they ought not to be ascended to, for they are not bound to obey any law which tends to destroy them. So that gets into a whole interesting concept about states' rights. All right. And let's see. He goes on. He's got two more paragraphs I want to be able to finish in these last 5 minutes of this segment. It appears to me that the economy... let me start that again. I'm sorry. It appears to me that had economy been a motive for making the representation small, it might have operated more properly in leaving out some of the offices which this Constitution requires. I am sensible that a great many of the common people who do not reflect imagine that a numerous representation involves a great expense, but they are not aware of the real security it gives to the economical management in all the departments of government. Man, he called it right there. Just right there. Why do we have the Department of Education, EPA, all of this other stuff? So he was calling it out right there, even at that time under the Constitution. You got too many departments. It was already too big a government. The gentleman further declared that as far as his acquiescence extended, the people thought 65 a number fully large enough for our state assembly, and that's of New York, and hence inferred that 65 is to 240,000 as 65 is to 3 million. This is curious reasoning. That's pretty much what they were looking at for the House of Representatives at the time the Constitution was formed. I feel that I have troubled the committee too long. I should not indeed have risen again upon this subject had not my ideas been grossly misrepresented. So it comes back that we have to stand true in what is misrepresented in those types of things that we say, and we have to stand true on the grounded principles of what that is, and we have to argue them efficiently and appropriately, and we know that the enemy, the Democrats, the socialists, the communists within America, within our two-party environment, within this cold civil war that Kessler talks about, is something that is a real battle. And we're going to get into that in depth in the third segment. But with some of the things that I want to review is that what he was talking about here in the 65 representatives relative to the 240,000, that was the population in New York at the time, and they had 65 representatives for the 245,000 in the state of New York. And then he's going, well, look, when we look at the population base and how many representatives there are going to be in relationship to the population of 3 million, it's almost like that ratio of 65 representatives are now going to be for 3 million. How's that going to work? So that became part of the argument. And to the extent that what's really going to happen, and he doesn't even get into the Senate in this argument, but that becomes the even greater part that has been destroyed in so many different ways, especially by the 17th Amendment, which we've talked about in the past. And, you know, always have to revisit that. But it comes down to, what are we going to do? Sharpen up, folks. Sharpen up. Sharpen up your arguments and get engaged in the conversation. And, you know, get to that point, too. You got to know when you walk away. I was on a conference call today, and that was one of the points, is that when do you walk away? Well, there's times you're going to run into people that have no knowledge and just are emotionally fraught. There's just no other way about it. And so at that point, you have to say, you know what, I'm going to pray for you. I know you'll never understand what I'm talking about because you don't have a willingness to know Founder's truth. Then you just walk away. And let them stew, yell, throw water at you. Hopefully it's not anything worse than that. But, you know, that's ultimately what's happening because we have a revolution going on. We have that. We're going to talk about that in the third segment. So as we close out this segment, remember, you can look at the archives at SamuelAdamsReturns.net because Samuel Adams has returned And yes, those anti-federalists, they absolutely got it right. And it all comes down to, are we a moral and virtuous people standing up against the evils as our founders did? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to this last segment of Samuel Adams Returns. Those anti-federalists, they absolutely got it right. And we've just been having a good time with Melancton Smith. He is, again, one of my, well, all of the anti-federalists are my favorites, but Melancton Smith was taking it on. He was just jumping in there. And you have to remember that by this time, by the time that New York was really going through their arguments and having their debates on the Constitution, a Constitution fundamentally based on the requirements of ratification was met. You know, so they were arguing more to establish what should go in as some ideas around amendments, because at the time they already got the news that the Constitution, there were enough states that accepted it and ratified it, so that's all they needed. You know, all they needed was the 9 states. They got them, and bing, bada, bing, the Constitution was going to go into effect. But it was not an exercise in futility. It was an exercise in principle and how governance should work. So very, very interesting when we look at representation. And key points that I want to bring out from this June 23rd discussion was the fact that, number one, there are those that will take a principled argument and render it down nothing. So there are those that are out there, especially those in modern times who really understand that Delphi technique, and they're going to put you in a corner and they'll call you names, they'll ostracize you, do all of those other types of things. But we have to have the intestinal fortitude when put in those situations, and that is to stand up and call them out. Wait a minute. Are you pulling that Delphi technique on me? Are you just trying to ostracize me and belittle me? Are you saying, based on your fact that you believe everybody has something important to say, that you're trying to put me in a box and in a corner and take me apart? Because, you know what, that goes against even the fundamental principles that you say you believe in. So, you know what? I think you need to rethink that, and you need to hear me out. And if you don't want to hear me out, then I think you should leave, because the rest of the people want to hear me out. So don't try to facilitate me out of existence, because your facilitation is developing a miscalculation and a lie relative to what we may be talking about. So that happens out there. And those are some of the things I'll get back into it. There's an archive program on Delphi. And, you know, I know that there's other groups that do seminars and all those other training sessions on Delphi technique. It'll be something we get back to somewhere in here. Let's see. Next lesson learned. Next lesson learned was how things get misjudged and where prejudices are. And in that was the argument about aristocracy and the aristocrat. And it was interesting how the gentleman ridiculed Mr. Smith for being an aristocrat, and yet here's Smith that was talking against aristocracy. And his point on that being that those with power and those with money have interest only to gain more power and more money. And the counter argument that the gentleman made was that, well, the poor want to be a constable. The poor want to do, you know, this, that, or the other thing. And the reflection, which we have seen in this 2018 election more than ever before, we've talked about the Republicans and the establishment and all of that. You know, everybody yaps about it. You know, they talk about it all the time. But the reality and the fact is that those that have that power capacity will do more damage to the government and in the party than us middle class folks and even the poor who are trying to, you know, have a little bit of influence. We see that all the time. But we see it, as he was saying here, the third point that you need to capture is that the government is supposed to have the middle class. And as I mentioned in the first segment, and which Kathy and I have talked about, and I'll mention it again, is that, you know what, we need to get the churches actually educating again, that we don't need just to be running out to a mission field somewhere else, is that according to Reformation teaching, if you follow Reformation teaching, is that we are to be engaged politically for the here and now, as well as being prepared for all of eternity. Because God is sovereign over everything, and if we're representatives of his sovereignty, we better be doing the right thing. Otherwise, we're shirking our responsibility. But that is the theological description, according to Tom. Which, you know, hey, I said before, what does that mean? But think about it. I want you to think about it. So then he goes on to the fourth point that we need to do something about. So closing out that other point is that, you know, go and get your pastors to read the book or watch the videos on chaplains and clergy of the revolution, because 95% of the pastors in America are not doing what would hold America as a moral and virtuous people engaged in good government. Okay, so then he just closed it all out with representation. You know, you got to understand that the real First Amendment, it never fully ratified. And the real First Amendment was that about 30,000 people with one representative. But, you know, here we are. You know, million plus with one representative. So where's that leave us? That leaves us with a few kind of cycle rounds and chats about what this article is here with Mr. Kessler. I do like it very much. There is the critical components of what he has to say, I think, from an educational perspective, is that during that time of Wilson, and always, as I've mentioned before, and I talk about in the seminar, in the book, is that what we've seen is that the progressive movement actually started in the mid to early 1800s. Remember, Fabianism and all of that was even prior to our friend, that, you know, leader of the communist movement, Karl Marx, and that we have to understand that Sam Adams, in particular, said that, you know, everything that you would look at for utopianism is unconstitutional. And that was under the English Constitution when he wrote that. So when we come to here, this is nothing new. The battles are nothing new. It's just that we have this complexity of the reality that the enemy is using our Constitution against we who understand the truisms of it as a moral people. And that is because they want to do their own thing. I really like a couple of the statements he says in here about Wilson, and that he looked at it from the Darwinian perspective. He called the Founders' Constitution the Newtonian, and he called his ideas of the new Constitution Darwinian. Very, very interesting. What that means is they threw God out. Like that, they threw God out. So you throw God out, then it becomes godless all along. Ooh, that throws morality out. Ooh, that throws out everything that was preached during the Great Awakening that established the foundation for these United States. And to have the revolution against tyranny. Tyranny. What you have under these new ideas from Wilson and before is actually tyranny. You got to understand that. He doesn't talk about it. This guy's really nice. I like the way he writes. He's really nice. I'm pretty like punching the nose type thing here. But I guess you need nice people to be able to describe this, because people listen better to nice people than they listen to people that want to punch him in the nose with reality and truth, because it hurts. So Kathy just gave me the 5-minute signal here, and we have to kind of jumped through a couple other ideas that I wanted to talk about with this guy. You know, he talks about all of the conservative contrast to those of the liberals. And one of the important things that he said, and what I like out of the whole, I guess, the culmination of where we are today, is that he talked about in a previous book that he wrote, is that the left had only a couple places to go. And one of those places to go is that they had to radicalize. They either had to dissolve or radicalize. And ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what we have seen them do 100% in this. When you look at Bernie, the sandpaper, and what's her name, Ortega? Is that Ortez, and the dude that was running for Senate down there in Texas, who was pretending to be Hispanic, and the fact that he was a white guy. And now he's being hailed as the next Obama, which Obama was half white and half black. And so I guess this guy could use a Mexican connotation to his name while being a white guy. So the precedent is set for, you know, some of that confusion there. But the point is, once again, we are dealing with these radicals. And I heard a talk by Gorka on YouTube last night, and where he was saying that 53% of the millennials, maybe more, 64% of the millennials are really up for socialism or communism. They're radicalized. And so we are in a, not just a culture war with, you know, people wanting to shift their gender at a whim. Again, that's a moral issue. But where we really are at in that whole radicalization is, what does that mean from taking Wilson's insanities that I've talked about? Philip Drew, remember, I told you, go read Philip Drew, because everything in Philip Drew Administrator happened under the Obama administration. And this is what's freaking them out, is that Trump read the book. Trump read the book. Trump read Philip Drew. Trump knows their insanities. He knows their whole idea and plan to take and create an administrative state, statism, which, if you want to really call what it is, it's fascism. All right, we've been under fascism, as you've heard me say before, for a long period of time. Anyway, let me see where else he has here. So he's talking about where we're at now, and I don't know that I agree with him, but, you know, we could, I'll just state it because I think it's useful for argument and what we have to plan to do. He's going here, that leaves us two possibilities, which we need to get back either to the federal system, or everything's going to kind of collapse. Anyway, I don't have my reading glasses. I dropped them on the floor, believe it or not, so I'm not going to be able to read the whole thing of this. No. So, we have two possibilities if we let things go according to the way that they're going to go, and that's a disaster. But if we, in a middle America, the middle class, we stand our ground, we get out there and we converse, we want to, and literally, it is a verbal fighting. It is a fight of principle, and it is a prayerful fight. God has given us a great opportunity with Donald Trump and some of the people that we have elected. You know, let's get past this conservative insanity. That's why I wrote the book, Not All Conservatives Are Constitutionalists. We need to get back to the whole concept of principled constitutionalism. That's the big difference. And that is fundamentally what we need, because those that call themselves conservatives are, you know, whatever. So this is our battle, ladies and gentlemen. And so what do we need to do? Not only do we need to get boned up, but you need to get engaged. You need to get your feet on the street. You need to take, and if you have to go in there, if you're allowed to sit in on what's happening with the Republicans, you need to develop your next set of candidates, especially those that are going to be running for, yes, The schools, you need to replace every one of the people on the school board with constitutionalists. Because that's what Sam Adams said we should have in our educational system. And we'll come back next week when the anti-federalists, yes, they did. They got it right.